right, man. Welcome to Crow 777 Radio. This is hour one of episode 675. It's me and Jason today, and we're going to take apart the DOJ or Department of Justice. You know, you have to consider another 10 years from now, do you suppose we'll even have elections that resemble what used to happen in the past? It's hard to imagine what's going to come, but what is certain is people are waking up to so many things that it is forcing these old low vibrational systems that we've known all our life to come apart, and they will begin to disintegrate, in my view. Anyhow, welcome, Jason. You wrote the notes for this. Anything you want to add in?
Well, there's a lot that went on, a lot more than I knew about, that's for sure. This was another one of those, there's so much to put in that it's got to be a two-parter.
I mean, the more you look at just about everything, here's an example. When you go, one of the first things I did when I got your notes is I looked up the Great Seal, you know, like the coat of arms for the DOJ, well, basically the United States. And everywhere you look it up, even on their site, it says it was either derived or related to Manessa. And that's all it says. When we get there, I'm going to break that down, because why? You know, why don't they admit what's going on here? And if you go to Wikipedia, they'll tell you that everything I'm about to cover is false, which kind of tells you there's something to it. But anyhow, let's jump in.
Well, before we do that, let's just take a moment to remember that a lot of the founding fathers were Freemasons, and they really do love their symbolism.
Right, which includes the temple. The temple that lasted for 49 years or whatever it was the time I looked it up. But let's do it.
The United States Department of Justice, the DOJ, is the federal executive department that is responsible for enforcing federal law, administering justice, and ensuring public safety. It can trace its origins directly to the nation's founding, with a formal department being established later with an accompanying seal and motto.
So their motto and their mission statement, which is right here, they're supposed to administer justice and ensure public safety, and they're supposed to impose, enforce federal law. But based on what we've recently seen, they're not doing any of this. So if that's obvious to the majority of people, what can the possible future of an organization like this be when their stated motto, their stated mission statement is not being adhered to on any level?
Now, many people might wonder, why are we having a go at the DOJ? The most recent situation that should be making you have a whole lot of questions is the handling of the Jeffrey Epstein files and the numerous people who are described as having been a part of doing unspeakable things while having an association with Jeffrey, often repeatedly over the course of many years. As far as the mainstream states, convictions were secured, with Jeffrey Epstein having faced federal sex trafficking charges in 2019, in which he is officially stated as having died while in custody before the trial. Ghislaine Maxwell, his cohort, was convicted in 2021 on sex trafficking charges and is currently serving a 20-year sentence. These two remain the only major federal criminal outcomes that are tied to the entire Epstein network. As far as anything else is concerned, the official DOJ and FBI conclusion via a July 2025 memo that was reaffirmed in 2026 statements by Deputy AG Todd Blanch is that after exhaustive review, there is no client list, no creditable evidence of blackmail, and no basis to open new investigations or bring charges against uncharged third parties. Mere association, flights, or mentions in files do not constitute prosecutable evidence of federal crimes. Make of that what you will.
So there's a lot going on with the Epstein files, and I think it's more a device than it is anything else. I think it is absolutely serving the revelation of method. For those who are not aware of that, you can refer back to things like King Kill 33. You can get that on Michael Hoffman's site, revisionisthistory.org. What it basically comes down to is events are released to the public. The truth or some version of it is admitted. Time goes by. Nothing is done. Then they collect your tacit permission as the public, as a whole, because you've been informed of horrible things and nothing has been done against it. Here we have a department of the federal government with a mission statement that is completely ignored in any of this. Most people are reasonably sure that he is not dead, the man named. Most people are reasonably sure that the lady is not in jail. And everybody knows damn well through what they've released that there's been endless crimes to the point where there's no way you could hold a trial in 2019 and have this all worked out and the guy neatly in jail and killed in this much time. In other words, the entirety of this thing is a put up. Knowing this, how can we take seriously that it was an evidential dump to the public in some way? And what makes it worse is all of the victims are not blacked out in these documents, yet the people who we assume are guilty of doing these things are blacked out. So up is down, left is right, and here we go along. But above it all, this is revelation of method in the same way 9/11 was. Most people know 9/11 was a put up. Nothing has been done about it. Tacit permission will be collected according to how they think and operate.
So one may certainly be asking why there are no further prosecutions despite substantial evidence claims in the files. The mainstream answer is that the DOJ does not charge based on public perception, flight logs, or civil suit allegations. Federal sex trafficking cases require admissible evidence that proves knowledge and intent beyond a reasonable doubt, or at least probable cause for indictment. Much of the released material shows social and/or financial ties or victim statements that are considered hearsay, are time-barred, as in statutes of limitations, or insufficient without some sort of corroboration. Draft indictments from the 2000s named unnamed co-conspirators who were mostly employees recruiters, but those were never pursued after Jeffrey Epstein's 2008 non-prosecution agreement. As far as the Epstein files themselves are concerned, the bipartisan Epstein Files Transparency Act that was signed on November 19, 2025, the DOJ released 3.5 plus million pages, 180,000 plus images, and 2,000 plus videos by the time of January 30th, 2026. This includes flight logs, internal memos, a draft indictment that was drawn up by prosecutors in 2007 that named Epstein and several of his assistants as co-conspirators but was never pursued, diagrams of Epstein's inner circle, and communications naming dozens of prominent figures.
I mean, the only thing anyone can deduce is that this is so widespread that there are endless institutions and law enforcement places that are involved in it. But when you come out and say that there's no probable cause, that's a bit laughable. You want probable cause? All the way back to when I was young, I saw faces on milk cartons and reports of how many people go missing. There's your probable cause. We don't really need to say much more.
On September 24th, 1789, President George Washington signs the Judiciary Act of 1789, which establishes the federal judiciary and creates the office of the Attorney General. This is a part-time, one-person position with no formal department at this time. It also establishes U.S. attorneys, one per district, to prosecute federal cases, and U.S. Marshals Service, which is the oldest federal law enforcement agency. This last is for dealing with court security, fugitives, and prisoners. Edmund Jennings Randolph is sworn in as the first AG on September 26th. The AG role includes legal advice to the president and Congress, along with limited litigation. The initial salary for the position is lower than other cabinet members, with early attorney generals often maintaining their own private practices. Randolph resigns in 1794 to become Secretary of State, with successors William Bradford and Charles Lee facing the same constraints. The office remained a one-person operation with growing but uncoordinated federal legal needs, such as early land disputes and neutrality enforcement during European wars.
You know, it's getting harder and harder to address topics like this with a straight face. What's going on in the world right now is people are working to show you just how phony all of this is. These people are characters, almost all of them. And this has been a put up from the beginning. And anyone who goes back, who starts digging into things like what were the states' rights? What were the Fed rights? You see the game that's been played. And I'll say a few things when we get to the seal. And I'm not going to tell you they're true, but this is admitted in an offhand way anytime you look up the Great Seal. And it is very difficult to sit here with a serious face and address anything to do with the federal government at this point.
Moving into the 1800s, workload for the AG increases with the westward expansion, as there is need to deal with land claims, revenue enforcement, and Supreme Court cases. But the structure stayed static in the first few decades of the 1800s. There is still no sort of centralized control, with federal litigation being handled by U.S. attorneys in districts on a fee-based system that had AG oversight. In 1818, Congress finally authorizes a clerk for the AG office, making it the first staff member. In 1819, the AG role in congressional representation ends, which is shifted elsewhere. By the 1830s, AG opinions become more formalized, but enforcement still remains fragmented. Attorney generals like William Wirt, who was the longest serving from 1817 to 1829, as well as others, lobbied for more authority, including supervision of U.S. attorneys, but this failed. President Andrew Jackson supported the idea, but Congress did not act. In 1830, there is an unsuccessful push to make the AG full-time with no private practice allowed. However, Congress rejects the notion as they are wary of concentrating power.
All right, if we're going to address the skit, the play, that is what's ruling this country right now. Everyone knows who Andrew Jackson is. He's on a $20 bill. He's a character. And that's becoming well known now. Most people are still denying it, but it's beyond denial at some point. It's not just him. It is so many of them. And when we look at this with a critical eye, and Jason and I have covered, what was the date with the Constitution? Jason, do you remember the date the Constitution was swapped around and fudged up?
1871.
1871. That's quite a ways ago. And to this day, people walk around citing that they have constitutional protections. And for so long, we've overlooked what is right obviously in our face. And it's time we stop doing that. What I'm saying here is Andrew Jackson was an important man in this country, so important he went on a bill on the currency. He's a character. I don't know what else I can add.
Moving into the 1840s and 1850s, the federal government is growing with new territories forming. There's the aftermath of the Mexican-American War and slavery and fugitive slave issues that lead to more litigation. At this time, legal functions are still scattered across departments. The Treasury Solicitor handles revenue, customs, and the Interior, which is created in 1849, loosely supervises U.S. attorneys' accounts funding. Other departments hire their own counsel as needed. The AG still lacks supervision over U.S. attorneys, despite there being repeated requests from AGs, as well as from Presidents Polk, the 11th President, and Pierce, the 15th.
Go ahead. They're trying to establish the DOJ here.
On February 22nd, 1849, the Act for Authenticating Certain Records authorizes an official seal for the AG office that is adopted around 1850 by AG Reverdy Johnson under President Taylor. It will be the basis for the later DOJ seal. This is considered a modest but significant step in formalizing the office's administrative identity during the pre-department era and addresses a long-standing practical gap in that there was no statutory provision for an official seal to authenticate copies of its records, documents, or certifications, which is something that was increasingly needed as federal legal work had been growing throughout the years. This corrected an omission from the Judiciary Act of 1789, which had created the AG office, but made no mention of a seal. It allowed official copies of AG records, to now carry legal weight through a sealed certification, similar to how other departments authenticated documents. Without this, the AG's office had been relying on ad hoc methods or lacked formal evidentiary authority for copies.
So it should be apparent by what Jason just read that seals are a big deal. They're referred to often as devices. All the kind of occulted work that we've done, you should recognize that any shape has an energy. Logos are more than just pretty pictures, but this is a seal. And they're saying things like, there's no statutory provision because we don't have an official seal to authenticate it. I mean, when you think about it, it's almost ridiculous. Does putting a seal on a document change it in any way? Well, apparently it does, because they go on to say AG records now carry legal weight through sealed certification. So I think we can agree that based on what they're putting forward, the idea of implementing a seal is a big idea.
Seals have been a thing not just for hundreds of years, but for thousands of years, going back to the ancient Roman Empire and all that. Having a seal, an official seal on a document, says this is something that we, meaning whatever body that we're referring to, are officially standing behind, so you better notice it or else.
That's right. It did give authority. And even in other cultures, like in Asia, they had a thing called a chop that they would stamp. They're basically miniature logo. But how many movies have you seen where the guy's wearing the ring with the family crest or something on it, all the way back to when they were supposedly writing in wax? They would seal it that way in the Roman Empire. For some reason, as we went forward in time, we quit paying attention to such things. But what we just read kind of shows you that they're almost saying everything we did before we had this seal was ad hoc and it lacked evidentiary authority. I mean, that's a pretty big statement. Then they go on to say, oh, now we've authorized this. Now this is all authoritative because we have the seal.
We could probably ask Fortune about this, but even major families, important wealthy families, or royal families would have their own seal.
And not only that, a coat of arms. And many times you and I have considered going at it, but it is so complex. Almost beyond reason. And for anyone who remembers, do you remember the James Bond that was really early, Jason, with the guy that did one show?
On Her Majesty's Secret Service.
There you go. He stands in as a guy from the Royal Coat of Arms place, and he's supposed to authenticate. But those are real things, and I have books on it. And when you look at what goes into a coat of arms, it is complex beyond even really easy explanation. And all of the important families had a coat of arms. And what's weird is when I was very young, my father gave me this hand-drawn thing, which said my grandfather had it made. There was a coat of arms, which I've never seen or heard of, where there's no one royal in my family at all. Just workaday blue-collar people in the military up to my father's time. He was just a teacher. So was there a time in the early 1900s when coats of arms were common to families? I don't know. But when I saw that, I thought, well, where did this even come from? And I have no idea to this day.
The seal, which will see minor changes, but remain more or less the same once the DOJ becomes an official department, is a close adaptation of the eagle and shield motif from the Great Seal of the United States, with the addition of a Latin motto. It is described as follows. Circular, with Attorney General's office in gold lettering encircling the whole. Inside, there is a shield with paleways, or vertical stripes, of 13 pieces of argent, white silver, and gules, red, and are said to represent the 13 original states. It also has a chief, which is the top horizontal band that is azure, or blue. There is said to have been a heraldic error in that the stars that are visible on the shield are improperly placed on the chief, the total number of which is obscured beneath the eagle that stands on the shield. The bald eagle is shown facing the viewer's left and is rising with outstretched wings, standing on or emerging from the middle of the shield. There was no specified number of tail feathers, wing feathers, or other details, which at this time would have varied by the engraver and not fixed like in later versions. Held in the eagle's right talon is an olive branch, which is said to symbolize peace. There is no number of leaves or berries on the branch that are explicitly detailed in pre-1870 descriptions, but sources describe it as an olive branch without deviation noted, so the standard 13-13 count is the most consistent inference that matches the 1872 transfer and later formalization in 1934. Held in the eagle's left talon are a bundle of arrows, which is said to symbolize war and power. Again, originally, there was no exact number stated, but was described as being identical to the Great Seal's bundle of 13 arrows. Lastly, there is the Latin motto, Qui pro domina justitia sequitur, in a semicircle or arc below the central device, which translates to, Who follows for Lady Justice?
I mean, that's a pretty weird thing with no, I mean, you can't almost pin it down. Who follows for Lady Justice? At any rate, we're going to get into this a little bit. I don't know if people remember Trump at one point did this press thing where I noticed the eagle was looking the opposite way at the arrows in his hand. And look where we are now. It's always supposed to be looking left, and we have so forgotten about the importance of seals and things like this, coats of arms, that I'm guessing the majority of people at that press conference didn't notice that the eagle was no longer looking at the olive branch of peace, which I think typically now has 13 of everything like it always has. But here's what got me. When I started looking at this, it kept saying that it was somehow related to the seal itself, where it came from, was somehow related to or derived from Manasseh, M-A-N-A-S-S-E-H. Well, I knew that to be a biblical tribe of Israel, but it doesn't say that. And when you try to look at the DOJ and other places, they're not giving you anything. So I dug in. Now, I'm not here to tell you any of this is true, but I am here to tell you that if you look it up on Wikipedia, they'll tell you it's some pseudo-history from some dude who made up a bunch of poppycock. But there's a whole book around this, and I looked at the book, and it was heavily researched. I'll leave that where it is. Here it is. The name Manasseh means to forget. That's interesting. But there's also a harder-to-find meaning, which means from a debt. The Great Seal of the United States is often associated with the tribe of Manasseh. Well, I've never been told that. Why does it just say Manasseh? But here it is in black and white. As it incorporates symbols believed to reflect the heritage and blessings of this tribe. We're talking about one of the biblical tribes and the lost tribes here. The seal features elements like an olive branch and arrows, which are linked to Manasseh's historical significance. The symbol, the tribe's banner, was described in the Talmud as a black flag with an embroidered unicorn. Manasseh is one of the 10 lost tribes. Well, wait a minute. None of this makes sense. You're telling me they had a black banner with a unicorn. How does that resemble or relate in any way to what we were just told? It goes on. The tribe of Manasseh is one of the 12 tribes of Israel descended from Manasseh, the firstborn son of Joseph. After the Assyrian invasion, in 720 BCE, it became known as one of the 10 lost tribes. Here's the other thing. When you begin to dig in and find out about the tribe of Manasseh, it's bizarre. It's actually half a tribe, and then it's not really recognized as a tribe, but it is just if you look at it, it's weird to say the least. Goes on to say, after the exodus from Egypt, the Israelites entered Canaan under Joshua, who allocated land to each tribe. What are we doing right now in this part of the world? The territory, Manasseh, was unique as it was divided in two halves. There was East Manasseh, which was east of the Jordan River, which include Bashan, and West Manasseh, west of the Jordan, north of Ephraim. The author who wrote and claimed all this was true, his name was Herbert W. Armstrong, and he wrote of the Worldwide Church of God. It was written near 1933, of course, in a book called The United States and Great Britain in Prophecy. The claim is made that the United States was primarily descended from the tribe of Manasseh after the Assyrian captivity and subsequent migrations. And lastly, sorry for the long wind here, Jason, the tribe of Manasseh is one of the 12 tribes of Israel descended from the firstborn Joseph. And when you look up this information, it is a split tribe and almost like it was hidden or written out, or you just kind of have to look to see. But Jason, were you aware of anything I just read?
No, not at all.
I mean, we look at the seal and it claims some relationship to Manasseh. So you think, okay, well, they must have used their coat of arms. But when you go see their banner, it's black with a unicorn. None of it makes sense, which makes me wonder how much of this has legs. That was a lot of words, but it's kind of important, isn't it? This is one of the major devices and seals of this country, and nobody seems to know this connection.
Right, which actually brings us to our next point. Because, for a bit of possible occult symbolism translation for the seal, the eagle could be thought of as being a direct extension of the Great Seal of the United States conventionalized phoenix motif, which is reified by the triple 13s of the olive branch, arrows, and stripes on the shield. The phoenix is considered a powerful symbol of rebirth, renewal, and immortality across alchemy, mythology, and multiple occult traditions. In alchemical transmutation, it marks the final rubido, or reddening, stage of the great work, which is supposed to be the creation of the philosopher's stone, purification by fire. And there's more to come.
Right, and that's rubido, the reddening. But let's ask a simple question here. We know what's going on in the world right now. There's a war that very few people are around. Of course, it's in the biblical Holy Land again. But whatever it was, 1 or 2 years ago, when Trump got up, and it was all on film, by the way, and there was a side box with the seal in it where the eagle was looking at the arrows, which means war, which is obvious deviation from where it normally is. Were they telling us what they were going to do? How could it be anything else? How could you accidentally? I mean, even if you flipped the image, the eagle would look right, but he would still be looking at the olive branch, and that's not what was done. In other words, these things are important, and we've overlooked it for a long time. And if anything I just laid down is correct, that's a pretty big deal.
The number 13 with the arrows, olive leaves, and stripes is conventionally thought to refer to the original 13 colonies. However, from a more occult point of view, the number 13 is thought to represent rebellion, lawlessness, and upheaval, which leads to a controlled rebirth, symbolizing the destruction of the old order so that a new and engineered one can rise, like the phoenix rising from its ashes after being consumed by flames. This can also tie in with the tarot's 13th card, death, which is normally interpreted not literally, but as ego death or societal collapse preceding regeneration. There are also, of course, the claims of the 13 Illuminati bloodline families.
You know, years ago when we saw something like this, we dismissed it. It was laughable. You couldn't imagine it. But now we see all of these major systems and infrastructures that we've known all our life are coming apart. They're coming down, and something's going to replace them all. It becomes much more critical to look at ideas like this. It would not surprise me in the least if the Phoenix encoding had gone into all this in the same way that now that I look back at what Trump was putting on TV to everyone out there, showing their device, looking towards war, telling people we're not going to war, coming 2 years forward, we're at war.
The olive branch in one talon and the arrows in the other can be seen as a dualistic mechanism, with the olive branch representing peace, mercy, and reconciliation, and the arrows representing destruction, enforcement, and war. This can be said to mirror the Hermetic or alchemical Latin motto, salve et coagulate, or dissolve and coagulate. This could represent the elite's tactic of orchestrating a crisis and having a resolution of their desire ready to go. You could think of it as first burning or dissolving the old order of resistance, sovereignty, and traditions through conflict, then coagulate or rebuild a new and centralized system that would be under hidden control. The eagle or phoenix could then be said to rise stronger from the engineered ashes with the olive branch emphasizing the peace of the new imposed order, which is why the bird's head is turned to the left and towards the olive branch, with the knowledge that the end game is always this controlled peace. This peace is, of course, not any sort of genuine liberty or freedom, but submission to the regenerated system.
Spot on. We've all been initiated, and the only person I know who's completely explained this is Michael Hoffman. If you go to Michael Hoffman's site, or you get his email each week, or if you're really smart and you subscribe to get his article each week, there's a little black image with text on it at the top of every one, which is the best description of what we're talking about. It basically says we've all been initiated into this alchemical process. We've been beat down. We're exhausted. We don't know which way is up. And revelation of the method is happening as we speak.
The shield, with its 13 stripes or paleways of red and white with a blue chief, could be thought of as the heraldic armor that is protecting the New World Order. The 13 stripes, which could be thought of as rebellion and or transformation, are the body of the Republic, with the blue chief representing divine or heavenly sanction, or the blue blood of the elite overseeing it all. From an alchemical perspective, red could represent base matter, fire, white is purification, rebirth, and blue, the elevated spiritual order that emerges. As can be seen, the interpretations can overlap. There are also the three mullets, or stars, in the annular ring of the seal. Three has strong occult significance, of course, which could represent the 3 degrees of the Masonic Blue Lodge, the Trinity in all of its many forms, or the three Masonic pillars of the Temple of Wisdom, Strength, and Beauty. The stars could be said to invoke completion, manifestation, or the triple goddess of Maiden, Mother, Crone, signaling that the DOJ's work is the final sealing of the elite's grandiose plans. The Rosicrucians also have their three lights of enlightenment, often referred to as the three profound Rosicrucian verities or the Sacred Trinity, which are light, life, and love. Since the stars were placed around the entire emblem, they can be said to bind the seal's magic, ensuring perpetual renewal under hidden control.
You killed it in your descriptions of the seal, Jason, grabbing from the mainstream but not treading on that side as you described it. But it's right here, signaling that the DOJ's work is in the final sealing of the elite's grandiose plans. I don't think there's many people who can see right now that doubt something like this is going on. My main point, and I think our main point, is that we've really got to pay attention to detail now, and we've got to ask the basic questions. When we read the seal of this country is somehow related to something like Manessa, well, what is that? Well, I think we're starting to know. And it's a big deal, and it's all coming to a close now, and something else is about to emerge.
Finally, the Latin motto could be seen as a veiled invocation to pagan goddess worship, with several different goddesses possibly being represented, rather than neutral legal service. From this point of view, the DOJ does not see abstract justice, but follows the occult lady, which is a feminine principle of balance that the initiates of the elite use to enforce their version and ideas of order. The United States uses feminine goddess symbols in other places as well, such as frequent representation of the goddess Columbia,
which we've covered many times, and what I'll describe again is obviously a signal to people who are in the know, but it's also got occult properties to it, in the same way a device or a logo would. What happens when you put something up for millions of minds to see? Mind precedes all, does it not? Columbia is the icon for Columbia Pictures. If you go back to, say, the 60s, you'll notice she's the light bearer. There's the Luciferian tie-in. And that torch is on the outside of the letter U, which is forming two upright columns, like the Masonic columns, Joaquin and Boaz. As we get closer to 9/11, the torch is moving to the left from our point of view, and at 9/11, the torch she is holding is exactly in between the two uprights, obviously signaling people who were in the know and doing what other mystical things we can only guess at. But the time for overlooking such details is behind us now.
Moving into the 1860s, the United States has to deal with the chaos of the Civil War, which causes massive disruptions for several years during and a good while after. The war breaks out in 1861, and Congress grants the Attorney General limited supervisory powers over U.S. attorneys and marshals via legislation that is steered by Senator Lyman Trumbull of Illinois. This is considered a wartime necessity and is shared initially with the Solicitor of the Treasury to coordinate federal prosecutions amid rising disloyalty cases, draft enforcement, and Confederate sympathizer trials. However, the AG still is lacking full authority or a dedicated department at this time.
Anytime they start talking about needing to change the laws and rules for wartime, you're looking at a country that's gone backwards. The eagle is supposed to be looking at the olive branches of peace. What's being described here is the exact opposite. We want to go to war, so we're going to give more power to the people who enforce our supposed laws so we can ensure that nobody gets out of line as we do the war we want to do, basically.
I actually was wondering when I was looking over all this stuff, if they really wouldn't want to have that much legal stuff going on as far as enforcement, because in war, atrocities often go on both sides.
Well, there's an example of law that we can relate to that. When you join the military, you're under DOJ law. And basically what it means is you've agreed to be the property of the United States. In other words, there has to be a special set of laws where all those heinous things go on to allow it to occur, because the laws that we live in wouldn't provide for such heinous activity.
The war lasts from 1861 until 1865. And federal caseload surges dramatically for multiple reasons. There are treason sedition prosecutions, confiscation of rebel property, military commissions and habeas corpus suspensions, and enforcement of the Emancipation Proclamation and early civil rights measures. The AG's office handles opinions and some Supreme Court work, but relies on private counsel and scattered solicitors for most litigation. There is no major push for a full law department yet, as the focus is on survival and war prosecution. The Confederate government has its own parallel setup, creating its own Department of Justice in 1861, also with an AG as head, which highlights how centralized legal structures were seen as useful during the crisis, but the Union government still delays.
If you really want to know what the Civil War was about, you're probably going to have to listen to someone who's interested in one form of law or another. It was a takeover, and it wasn't just a takeover, but it was so much more about gaining controls of things and monetary systems and realm states than it was anything else. How many people have seen Gone with the Wind? Regularly voted one of the best movies. Although now when they put it on, they have to warn you that terrible things were being done, because you have to be warned now that terrible things are being done, as they do terrible things. If you pay attention to Gone with the Wind, after the war is over and the carpetbaggers come in, you can see exactly what I'm talking about. All of a sudden, people are being told, and these times you got a $300 tax bill or you're going to lose your farm. This was a complete demolition of an old world system and replacement with controls, to be blunt about it.
Well, there's something that a lot of folks may not realize about the North and the South. The South was very wealthy before the Civil War, for several obvious reasons. But once the war is over, that's gone. And it's gone forever to this day. The South, as I think most people would probably think about in today's terms, is kind of looked at as being on the poor side. But that was just not true beforehand.
Not only was it not true, they had a definite culture that you could call American. They had an etiquette, manners. They had this whole world that was a lot more higher-minded than we are now, but it can't be seen because the slave argument is what's been pumped up and pushed into the front as the cause and everything else we did there. But I'm with you, Jason. Not only was it gone, it was completely gone. And there are any number, I mean, even in the movie Gone with the Wind, you can see, I think Rhett Butler at one point says the South is done and it will never rise again or something like that. It was erased from the board, and all of the etiquette and charm and a true American culture that might have been is lost in the slavery idea that's been pushed up and shown as the cause for the war when there was a heck of a lot more going on, to say the very least.
And there's evidence all over the place if you look, especially where I live in Louisiana. There still are plenty of big, beautiful homes from that time period that are all over the place, showing you the direct indication just how much money was flowing down here at the time.
And pride of craftsmen. You know, we could see that all over America in the 30s. There are people now doing YouTube clips on the old stoves, you know, those enameled, very heavy old stoves. They're showing how much functionality they had and how beautifully they were built and how they'll last forever. This was a time when people took pride in their work. And that's part of what gets destroyed when culture gets destroyed. We don't have culture anymore. As I've said so many times, we like some news programs, some TV programs, we watch some movies. That's about the entirety of American culture at this point.
What about hot dogs and apple pie?
There you go. We got a phrase too.
Once the Civil War concludes in 1865, the long and difficult journey of Reconstruction begins. The federal government puts forth a lot of effort to rebuild the South, reintegrate former Confederate states, and secure rights for newly freed African Americans, who are also known as freedmen. There is explosive growth in federal legal responsibilities, but the Office of the Attorney General remains a tiny and under-resourced advisory role that still has no centralized department, no direct supervision over U.S. attorneys or marshals, and no dedicated enforcement machinery. The AG's office was overwhelmed by the sheer volume of new litigation and constitutional questions, while Congress is pushing forward with landmark civil rights legislation without yet creating the tools for robust federal enforcement. On April 14, 1865, President Abraham Lincoln is assassinated, and Andrew Johnson is hastily sworn in as the 17th president on April 15th, who would go on to serve for the remainder of Lincoln's second term. Once in office, he quickly implements his own lenient Reconstruction plan, the Proclamation of Amnesty and Reconstruction, on May 29th, 1865, which allows former Confederates to form new state governments with minimal federal oversight. It also includes pardons for most ex-rebels and rapid readmission efforts.
Big, big changes, but here's the problem. I'll undermine it with a simple statement. The only thing that was assassinated was a character. That's it. There was a character assassinated. That is how deep the, I don't even know what to call it. Is it fraud? Is it, what is it? I don't know, but it's not what we think it is. And look at just the level of change that's coming behind all this. And there were actors on the stage helping it each step of the way.
On December 18th, 1865, the 13th Amendment, which abolishes slavery, is ratified. This ends legal chattel slavery, but creates immediate federal enforcement needs, such as preventing black codes, meaning Southern state laws that might restrict freedmen's mobility, labor, and rights, as well as addressing widespread violence against black people. The AG during this transition is James Speed of Kentucky, who was appointed in 1864 under Lincoln and would continue under Johnson until July of 1866. Speed is a modern unionist and provides legal opinions supporting Johnson's policies, such as military tribunals and pardons, but faces growing caseloads from confiscation proceedings, loyalty oaths, and early civil rights disputes. The AG office has only a minimal staff at this time, meaning a clerk or two, and relies on private counsel or departmental solicitors for most work.
This race baiting and hatred is going to go on for another 100 years beyond this. We're talking about the 1860s. In the 1960s, they're going to bring the National Guard into, where was it? Was it Little Rock, Arkansas, I think, Jason? They're going to say we're going to integrate schools. They're going to put it on the news, and they're going to ramp up the hatred and race baiting again as the governor shows up to say this. No, you can't do that. It's just all manipulation based on a horrible thing, which kind of shows you if you want to be upright, don't dip your toe in the wrong pond, because it will be leveraged to the point of destruction. And literally 100 years beyond this, on the evening news, a National Guard, a president, and a governor are going to be just inflaming the emotional hatred of this country.
This was the thing that will literally last all the way up through the 1960s. Just to set in motion a sequence of events that it's like a cultural thing. It gets embedded, especially in the South. And I think for the most part, it's gone now, at least in most places. These things obviously linger. But this is a big deal.
I would estimate if we were talking to people of color, they might not agree with that sentiment. But here's the problem. If you want something like racism to go away, you quit talking about it and you just treat everybody like the human being they are. But that is not what happens. And this is proof positive. We're talking about the Civil War. Then we're talking about the 1960s. And to some degree, the vestiges of all that hatred and damage that's been inflamed any which way you can imagine is still recessing into the culture we don't have.
On April 9th, 1866, Congress passes the Civil Rights Act of 1866 over Johnson's veto, which is the first major override in U.S. history. It is sponsored by Senator Lyman Trumbull, a Republican from Illinois, and declares all persons born in the United States, with the exception of Native Americans on tribal lands, to be citizens. They will have equal rights to make contracts, sue, own property, and enjoy full and equal benefit of all laws and proceedings for the security of person and property. It criminalizes interference with these rights and gives federal courts jurisdiction over violations. The act will rely on U.S. District Circuit courts for cases, but no dedicated federal mechanism exists at this time. The AG has no authority to supervise U.S. attorneys directly or to initiate broad prosecutions. Local Southern courts, who are often hostile, handle most cases, which leads to minimal enforcement. Freedmen's Bureau of Courts, which are military-backed, helped to fill some gaps temporarily, but are limited.
And they're military-backed. Let's cut to the chase here. The citizenship idea almost certainly goes back to Rome, but what does it actually mean in black and white? It means you are surrendering the God-given rights you were born with for a lesser set of rights that are wrapped up in the definitions of what it means to be a citizen, and you are also surrendering to come under the authority, in this case, of military-backed courts.
All right, so that's going to bring us to the end of hour one. When we get back for hour two, we're going to get into the 14th Amendment, which is actually something that's still discussed at times today.
Which is, it's all just so, there is no solid ground right now. And this is part of the initiation that Michael Hoffman talks about. You're so discombobulated that truly up and down don't even seem like a thing you can grasp onto. And that is the point where revelation of method comes in, the destruction of old systems and the replacement with new systems. The difference now is many, many people are waking up. And why is that? Because there is no lie in nature, and the cycles of nature that we live in ensure that this happens time and time again. And so as we go into the new period, it is my point of view that this kind of stuff we're talking about, it's going to lose absolutely in the long run, because the level of consciousness and the so-called vibration will not allow for low vibrational things to exist anymore. But the real question is, how long will it take to get there? And how much damage will be done trying to get there? But with that, we're going to wrap up hour one of episode 675. Hour one is free to everybody at crow777radio.com. That is crow777radio.com. Members know to log in for the whole episode. They get access to all the forums, comments, to the two-hour film called Shoot the Moon, which is quite a good film with 10 awards. They can get access to the solar stills, which people are printing, some of them up to around 50 inches. Those are views that I couldn't have hoped to have gained 20 years ago. Also, membership gets exclusive access to my solar work, which I'm praying will start any day, but the temp has to go up into the 50s or 60s before I can do that. With that, we're going to take a short break, and I'd like to wish you all a happy, healthy, and higher-minded new era. I hope to see you logged as a member for hour two. There it is, man. Cheers.
Belief is the enemy of knowing.